I'm Tony Kevin. I'm a former Australian diplomat. I have been retired from the diplomatic service since 1998, during which time I've written four books, including two books on rescue of asylum seekers at sea on their way to Australia. I was ambassador to two countries, to Poland from 1990 to 1994, and to Cambodia from 1994 to 1997. I wrote a book back in 2004 on the sinking of Civex, which was a terrible tragedy at sea that happened in 2001. 353 people drowned. There was a great public concern about that event, supported by the opposition Labour Party. And I think my book was an important historical record of the processes of inquiry in the Senate into that tragedy. I thought I'd never have to write another book like that again, but unfortunately, over the last 4 years, we have seen under a Labour government a similar pattern of mounting deaths at sea of asylum seekers trying to reach Australia. There have now, in the last 4 years, been 860 deaths in 18 separate incidents. And I felt that that was intolerable, and I felt I had to write a further book, which I've called Reluctant Rescuers. The reason for that title is that I've found that in every one of these 18 incidents, serious and legitimate questions can be asked about the rescue at sea response of the Australian Border Protection System to the knowledge it must have had of boats in trouble. I'm talking about the huge contradiction between a system that prides itself on being highly efficient and vigilant in patrolling Australia's borders, maritime borders, against irregular entry, and yet seems to be unable, when those people on small irregular boats get into trouble, to provide an equally efficient rescue at sea response to information that people are at risk of drowning. There's a huge moral and practical contradiction there between, on the one hand, a system that's highly efficient in detection and interception of all the boats it wants to detect and intercept. They never get through undetected. And on the other hand, seems to fail to save life in something like 1 in 40 cases. I'll give you those statistics again. 31,048 asylum seekers have arrived in Australia safely over the past 4 years. In those same 4 years, 860 people are confirmed or probable deaths. That means 1 in 40 of those people are dying on their way here. We wouldn't tolerate that in any other area of activity. We wouldn't tolerate it in Sydney Hobart yacht racing. We wouldn't tolerate it in mountain climbing. We wouldn't tolerate it in rock fishing. These are all activities where people voluntarily put their lives at risk to engage in a particular activity, be it ocean yachting or rock fishing or climbing. And yet when they get into trouble, we don't blame them for it. We simply go out there and, at great expense and risk, try to rescue them. We wouldn't tolerate a 1 in 40 death rate in any of those activities. So what is the difference that we apparently will tolerate a 1 in 40 death rate in boats bringing people to Australia? I think the difference is that we don't really regard these people as having any rights because they are stateless people. There's a passage in my book, Reluctant Rescuers, which I would like to read out to you. It starts from Hannah Arendt, the famous political thinker who was a Jewish refugee in 1939. She had a terrifying experience of going from country to country in Europe just ahead of the Nazis as a stateless refugee. And she found a gaping hole in the theoretical ideal that every human being is born with inalienable and defensible human rights. Such rights proved unenforceable, she said, whenever people arrived who were no longer citizens of any sovereign state. And of course, she no longer had her German citizenship papers. And she concluded that human beings are not born with rights, but only acquire them as a result of membership of a political community. As Peter Mayers commented on her work, despite the universal rhetoric, refugees are human beings who are in essence citizens of nowhere, which is to say they are human beings with no rights worth speaking of. Now, after World War II, the world agreed on the International Refugee Convention, which was trying to put an end to that for all time, to say that refugee rights actually come from their humanity, not from whatever state they're citizens of. So they can arrive on your borders with no papers at all and simply say, I'm a human being, I ask for refuge, and be treated with decency and compassion. When we allow 1 in 40 boat people to die on the way to Australia, we are denying our own support for that convention, because we are saying, look, we don't really value these lives in the same way that we value the lives of yachtsmen, for example, or mountain climbers or rock fishers. No, these people somehow have a lesser claim on our compassion and have a lesser claim on our responsibility to rescue people who ask for our help.
So you espouse the universalist ethic of every human being has a right to life, has a right to be rescued, and we as fellow human beings have an obligation to rescue them, no matter who or what their identity is.
Yes, that's right. I mean, in World War II, in naval battles between convoys and submarines, the battle raged. Each side was trying to kill the other in the self-defence. But as soon as people were helpless in the water seeking rescue, it was the universal maritime ethic of all sides to say, well, now that they're no longer fighting us, we will try to save their lives. And that is the standard mariner's code. When you know of people in trouble at sea, you go to their rescue without asking questions as to who they are, what papers they have, or why they're there. You simply do it.
So this mariner's code, is it enshrined in some kind of international law?
Yes, it is. It's represented in at least three international conventions to which Australia is signatory. The UN Convention on Law of the Sea, which contains sections on rescue at sea, the Rescue at Sea Convention, and the Safety of Life at Sea Convention. And in different words, Australia has signed up under those three conventions to take all possible speedy and efficient steps to rescue people who are known to be or suspected to be in distress at sea.
What is it about the way Australia frames these people coming in boats, or way in which we define them, especially politicians, and Australia as a nation, that makes them less human than the yachtsman that needs to be rescued?
Well, John Howard really started the train of public discourse on this when he said famously that asylum seekers presume on our generosity. In other words, he blamed them for asking us to live up to our ideals, which are really the ideals of the Good Samaritan, in showing compassion for a stranger. They presume on our generosity, said John Howard. And that has been really the dominant note in political discussion of this issue ever since. There's been always a subliminal tendency to blame the asylum seekers for putting us on the spot by coming here without permission, although they have a perfect right here, as in any other part of the world, to arrive on our borders and seek to be granted entrance as a refugee. That is a right we have given them by signing on the Refugee Convention. And yet there's always this hidden, if you like, resentment that they have put us in this position. And you see it coming through in the testimony of border protection personnel before coroner's inquests. You see it in official documents regarding border security, which persistently and deliberately dehumanise asylum seekers. You see it in all those contexts.
Can you give some concrete examples?
Well, let me give you an example of a statement made by the Minister for Home Affairs, Brendan O'Connor, in 2009. He's subsequently been replaced by Jason Clare. He was talking about an interception in 2009, 24 miles northwest of Ashmore Island. He said the successful interception again demonstrated the effectiveness of Australia's maritime security system. At any given time, Border Protection Command has a tactical surveillance program in operation, which includes a range of aerial, sea and land patrols to safeguard, detect and respond to maritime threats in Australian waters 365 days a year. The Australian government remains vigilant and committed to protecting Australia's borders. Now, you know, that rhetoric, apart from proudly boasting how good we are at detecting and intercepting all these boats, was totally overblown in terms of intercepting a little boat containing a few dozen asylum seekers. It's whipping up the xenophobic response and our vigilance and our commitment to protecting our borders.
The reason why your book, Reluctant Rescuers, has a narrow focus, and that's not addressing the issue of compassion towards asylum seekers once they get here, but while they're at sea. So we're talking about our obligations to rescue them if they get into trouble. I mean, what is the reason that you do that?
I know that there are a great many people and organisations working very hard to defend the human rights of asylum seekers once they're here. There's a whole area of discourse with very fine people whom I admire very much going on about issues of abuse of asylum seekers in detention centres at Nauru, previously in detention centres in Australia and so on. On the other hand, there's been very little sort of hard-headed focus on the issue of responsibility to protect human life at sea. So I saw a gap there that needed to be filled, and I've decided to focus my efforts on that area. Of course, I have views on questions of abuse of human rights in detention and temporary protection visas and so on, but I decided I wouldn't blur the focus of my public activism by getting into those areas.
But there's also another reason, isn't there? And you say this a number of times in your book, that it's also about the people that are working in border protection. You're saying that the way the government frames, or the opposition frames this problem, also has a huge impact on how these people that work in border protection see themselves as people.
Yes, it does, and I'm terribly aware of this. In my CivEx book in 2004, I talked about how dehumanising and how demoralising it was for our border protection personnel to have to do things to asylum seekers that were fundamentally inhumane, things like firing shots across their bows and terrifying people on board, things like saying that people had to jump into the water, many of whom couldn't swim, before they were allowed to be rescued. Things like towing them for 24 hours in a circle at sea until their boat sank under them. And more recently, things like when asylum seekers are terrified, having been intercepted by Australia and taken into custody, to fear that they're about to be forcibly returned to Indonesia as a result of a notice read out to them. They then set fire to their boat, it explodes, they're thrown in the water. The Australian crew on board are the first priority to be rescued, and asylum seekers trying to get on board the rescuing boats are actually pushed off, pushed back in the water. Now, five asylum seekers died in that event. I'm talking about Civ 36 in 2009 at Ashmore Reef. It's putting our border protection personnel, our sailors and our Air Force personnel, into situations where they have to deny their own essential humanity. What does it do to a RAAF crew if they have to fly over a boat which they can see is capsized, where they can see people drowning, and yet what they're supposed to do is simply record the fact, pass it back to headquarters, for headquarters to inform the Indonesian Search and Rescue Authority, there's a boat that's foundered in your search and rescue area, people are drowning, please do something about it. What does it do to our personnel to, as it were, stand by and watch people drown without being able to do anything about it? What did it do to the crew of the Australian ship at Christmas Island on the 14th and 15th of December 2010, when they were told, in a situation of complete storminess and inability to send up surveillance aircraft, when they were told, you have to go off your border protection station for 17 hours to guard the hulk of an empty boat on the other side of the island from causing a pollution hazard. When the captain and crew of that ship knew very well there was a high risk of another boat arriving during that stormy weather, as in fact it did, and 50 people drowned the following morning who would not have drowned had the Australian frigate been ordered to go back on station. The whole protocol and practice of the border protection system, which says we're not really about safety of life at sea, we're only about protecting our borders and safety of life at sea just incidentally when we, as it were, stumble on an emergency at sea, is very corroding of the ethics and decency of the very good men and women who work in our border protection and naval services.
Do you have any examples of that highlight the differences between the way we treat asylum seekers and those that aren't?
There's the famous case, of course, of Tony Bullimore, the yachtsman who was rescued from somewhere about halfway between Australia and South Africa in the middle of the southern Indian Ocean. I don't know whether it was in the Australian search and rescue zone or in the South African search and rescue zone, but for whatever reason, nobody asked whose zone it was in. We devoted enormous expense and effort to sending naval vessels down to rescue him.
He was actually a bit of a hero, wasn't he, when he came? When he was rescued, he was kind of treated as a hero for surviving under extreme conditions.
Well, we're fairly selective who we give those accolades to. We certainly don't call asylum seekers heroes for being rescued after 24 hours in the water. We simply regard that as a bit of a nuisance. And I think that's deplorable.
Just want to go back to that universalist ethic, the way we treat everybody should be equal. But what if a boatload of known terrorists were lost at sea within the Australian search and rescue zone? Do you think that they have a right to be rescued just as anybody else?
Well, according to our ethics of law and justice and accountability, the answer is, of course, yes, they do. I mean, everybody has a right to a trial. Everybody is presumed innocent till proven guilty. And just because you thought that a boat was full of terrorists would not give you a reason for not rescuing them. If they were drowning and sent out a message of some kind saying, please help us, we're drowning. So, and you deal with the issue of accountability for their alleged crimes in the appropriate way after you've rescued them. I think once we start down that slippery slope of saying who deserves to be rescued and who doesn't deserve to be rescued, in the end, you're in that territory of, you know, that famous set of propositions. I forget who first wrote them. First they came for the Jews and I said nothing because I was not a Jew, etc. In the end, they come for me. In the end, they will come for me. And ethics are indivisible.
I just want you to address that idea of capacity as well. I mean, you argue in your book that Australia does have the capacity to do, you know, to rescue the 860 people that have actually died in the last, 10 years, 13 years?
Yes, let me be very precise on this. The waters between Indonesia and Christmas Island are actually international waters that are all in the Indonesian search and rescue zone. That doesn't stop us from regularly, 97% of the time, picking up people who are trying to reach Australia, who we know to be trying to reach Australia. Sometimes we pick them up on the edge of our own territorial waters, which is a little ring of water 12 to 24 kilometres, nautical miles wide, surrounding Christmas Island. Sometimes, quite often, we go out into those international waters, which are in the Indonesian search and rescue zone, to rescue, intercept, take into custody a boat that we know to be in distress. And we know this because from a series of official press releases put out by Border Protection Command, the Department of Customs and Border Protection, they often say this boat was intercepted in response to a distress call or in response to evidence of distress. We do this regularly, and we do not distinguish between the boats we intercept in Australian waters around Christmas Island or the boats we intercept or rescue a little bit further out towards Indonesia. Of course we have the resources because we have devoted large parts of our defence effort, of our, if you like, national maritime security effort, to being able to detect and intercept boats coming towards Australia that we have not given permission to come. That's a national security tasking, and it's done very efficiently. My question always is, if we have these resources there to detect and intercept boats considered to be security threats to Australia, how is it that we sometimes fail to see them when people are drowning on them? Or how is it that sometimes we decide we're not going to rescue that one, we're going to ask the Indonesians to do it, in the full knowledge that the Indonesians very often have neither the capacity nor the inclination to do so? Now, we're just behaving in incomprehensible, inconsistent ways. And the result of that inconsistency is that 1 in 40 of boat people trying to get here die on the way. And it's been like that now for the last 4 years.
Just want to go back to that idea of vilifying the asylum seeker who comes on a boat, as opposed to, we don't in the same way vilify the asylum seeker who comes by plane or by other means.
It is curious. Asylum seekers who come by plane seem to come under a totally different moral protocol as far as Australia is concerned.
So why do you think that is? Does it have something to do with the sea, with the fact that we have this, we feel vulnerable?
I think we resent the fact that asylum seekers are deliberately and voluntarily risking their lives in a way that puts a moral obligation on us to rescue them. We really do not like that. On the other hand, we don't ever criticise people who go in Sydney Hobart yacht races in gale force conditions and get into trouble and have to be rescued at vast expense. We don't very often criticise people who go rock climbing without proper equipment and training and get into trouble and have to be rescued at vast expense. It's almost as if we resent having to help people who are not ours, who are not like us.
So you're saying it's racism?
Yeah, it's a kind of... It comes back to that Hannah Arendt discussion we were having. It's a kind of a sense that they don't really have the rights to be treated as citizens. They haven't sort of earned those rights, as it were, by being part of our community, their recent arrivals. And how this must be compounded with boat people who have no papers, haven't got here yet, not yet Australians. And yet the odd thing is that a few years down the track, our children will be playing soccer with their children. Our boys and girls might be going out with their sons or daughters. They might be driving our taxis. That, you know, they become part of our community a few years later, and yet they have to go through this terrible, as it were, and risky purgatory getting here. And it only applies to boat people. It's something about people coming by boat that scares the hell out of us.
Just on that notion of citizenship, but when you talk about compassion, I mean, often philosophers say that that's a thin sort of connection between people as opposed to a thick connection, which is things like citizenship or identity, ethnic identity. So isn't that why people find, even though they say they have compassion for these people, they find it very difficult to acknowledge and recognise their ethical obligations, because it is a very thin connection?
Yes, it's certainly a contested idea that human rights are universal, that they flow from being a human being, not from being an Englishman or an Australian or a Frenchman. Many people have been trying, against the horrors of the 20th century, to strengthen that concept. I found when I was a diplomat that there were certainly limits to Australia's application of universal ethical rules or principles to the conduct of our diplomacy. I remember being told by quite senior officers when I was talking about the horrors going on in Bosnia and Croatia and Serbia during the Yugoslav wars, when I was ambassador in Poland at the time, I was told fairly briskly, those issues lie outside our area of primary concern. So in other words, human rights concern was geographically divisible. We were allowed to care about what was happening in Timor, but we were not allowed to care about what was happening in Yugoslavia or even what was happening in Cambodia. I was told in no uncertain terms once, we're not here to defend the human rights of the Cambodian people, we're here to defend Australia's national interest. It comes back, I suppose, to the definition of what is Australia's national interest in all these human rights cases, and I believe that upholding a universal standard of human rights is in Australia's national interest, because if we don't, one day it will come back to bite us.
When it comes down to the reality of actually implementing policies and conducting everyday foreign relations with countries, then it's usually national interests or probably sort of hardcore interests. You know, our economic interests, our national security interests usually trump those of things like compassion or, you know, universal human rights. They tend to kind of be things that are a little bit distant, don't they? So national interest always trumps compassion.
I don't think there should be a conflict between the two. I mean, after World War II, when we were looking at the horrors of our prisoners of war coming back from Japanese prisoner of war camps, we certainly saw an Australian national interest in trying to improve human rights observances universally, including treatment of prisoners of war. I can't offhand think of too many cases where economic and political interests are directly in conflict with human rights interests. I can see situations of bad policy. For example, Australia was quite happy to sell wheat to and other commodities to Saddam Hussein's Iraq. Australia was quite happy to violate UN sanctions against Iraq. Now, maybe we were doing the right thing there because we were getting much-needed food into Iraq. But there's a lot of realpolitik in diplomacy, of course, and it's very hard to generalise. You have to look at each situation according to its specifics and on its merits. But I would be very loath to throw away the element of universal human rights thinking in Australian diplomacy. If it's not there somewhere in the mix, I don't think we can claim to be conducting a civilised diplomacy.
You've spoken about this, the issue that prompted you to write the book. But what about your personal reasons?
I think my own personal background probably has a bearing on this. My mother was a Jewish refugee from Vienna in 1939. She had to flee her country in fear of her life. She became a stateless person briefly until she married my father, who was an Australian, and that gave her Australian nationality. But, yeah, she was in the same situation Hannah Arendt was in. She was a stateless refugee, wondering what the future held for her. And, of course, when I think of a terrible event like the voyage of the St. Louis, a boat, a passenger liner full of Jewish refugees, many of whom were quite wealthy because they could pay for their passages, which tried to sail from Europe to America just before World War II, and was turned away from both Cuba and America on the basis of the thinking, we don't want to import Europe's problems here, thank you very much. The people were forced to return to Europe and they perished in concentration camps. I think events like that give these issues a personal immediacy for me that they might not have for most people. But I hope that I am approaching them in a universalist way. I'm certainly not one of the people who say that now that World War II is over and now that there's no longer a Jewish refugee problem, we can forget about all the other refugees. Because for me, an Afghan Hazara is in a situation not dissimilar to that of a European Jew in 1939. an Afghan Hazara is coming from a very dangerous country for him or her, where his community, his ethnic group, is regularly persecuted, and where he's in well-founded fear of his life because of his ethnicity. Now, you know, cross out the word Jew and write Afghan Hazara, and I don't see a real difference. You get compassion in a great many Australian areas of life, including, interestingly, in the Australian countryside. I had a bit to do during the CivEx period with a wonderful organisation called Rural Australians for Refugees. And I was always struck by the enormous compassion and understanding of these people, many of whom came from farms and small country towns, who opened their doors and opened their hearts to refugees in a way. I don't think one has to have travelled the world to recognise our common humanity with people of different races and ethnicities and religions. I think one can find that right here in Australia. We're not a racist country. We're a very multicultural country now. We're a very accepting country. I think there's a sense in which our border security system is out of tune, out of key with the prevailing community ethic in Australia. Because once boat people get here, they very quickly become just people. They become absorbed into communities, into community life. They don't form ghettos. They are very good people. They're well-liked. And so I think really our border security bureaucracy, and this is really why I wrote Reluctant Rescuers in the way I wrote it, has somehow got it wrong. They've come to see boat people, asylum seekers, simply as a national security threat, and they've lost sight of the humanity of boat people, asylum seekers. They no longer represent the general view of Australians, I don't think, because Australians, while on the one hand we've been taught to believe that asylum seekers are a threat, on the other hand, we are a country based on migration. We are a country based on a fairly large refugee intake. And we are a country that can cope with multiculturalism very well. We just have to rejig the settings of our border security service, it seems to me, to put human life first again, to go back to the idea that when you see someone, when you know of someone drowning at sea, you simply go out there and try to rescue them with all the resources you have.